WBSM presents The Tim Meisberg Show, streaming live on WBSM.com and the WBSM app. Call 508-996-0500. Send us app chat messages and open line voicemails using the WBSM app. Now, The Tim Meisberg Show.
Welcome back in. So I had mentioned earlier that because of the auction that happened with the Wizard of Oz ruby slippers going for $28 million, I had asked the question today, what movie prop would you most like to own for yourself? And again, with the caveat that it is just a prop. It's not going to actually do what it does in the movie. So If you buy the DeLorean from Back to the Future, you're not going to be able to time travel with it. You're just going to own the DeLorean that was in the film. That's the idea behind this. And Josh says, I would like to own one of the original proton packs from the Ghostbusters movie. That would be a cool thing to own. Although I will say, while it'd be one thing to have the original that the guys wore in the film, the people who make their own versions of them are making some incredible replicas. Like, I had this story before about Ethan, who has the, he made the Ecto-1 out of his Toyota. But he makes legitimate movie quality style props with another gentleman who lives here in Fairhaven. They make them together and they're creating stuff that looks like it came right out of the film. And the cosplay world, the dedication that people put into the accuracy of everything is amazing. Like, these are not just people who are dressing up like it was a Halloween costume. These are people who are investing the time, the money. And I say the money, but I don't mean they just go online and buy it. They're spending the money to get the materials to construct it themselves. And that's what finds it, that's what I find to be the most fascinating, is the level of skill that they have. And many times it's that they don't even know that they possess. But anyway, we can talk more about that coming up. Right now, though, it is time for us to turn the spotlight onto a local nonprofit organization. It's the South Coast Health Community Spotlight, in which South Coast Health is bringing to us some of the other great organizations that they partner with and that they work with in the community, or that they just know are doing good work. And it's time for us to learn about another one of those great organizations. We are joined now by Soraya Dos Santos, the founder and director of Sacred Birthing Village of South Coast. So, Soraya, tell us about what that means. Sacred Birthing Village South Coast. What is the organization? What do you do?
Yes, blessings to you. Wow. Such a powerful question, because oftentimes that piece of like it's an organization, Sacred Birthing Village, is so much more than that. She embodies this beautiful and powerful divine wisdom and spirit, a really this need for tending to what is most sacred in and around our community, and really what is humanity. And that is being able to center and to caretake for those that are literally the carriers and life givers of life, right? And so Sacred Birthing Village, we are a maternal restorative village providing care and support to our BIPOC, pregnant and birth individuals and families. We do that by various ways. One of them being our Sister Friending Program, which is a peer-to-peer relationship program support, where a pregnant individual or a newborn mother is paired with a volunteer, someone who serves as a volunteer who has gone through their own, you know, sort of sacred rite of passage. Doesn't necessarily mean just childbirth. And so they're paired with a pregnant individual and their family, and really to provide the support, to provide the witness and elevation that is required and necessary through the individual person's rebirth through childbirth.
So when you say it doesn't necessarily mean the birthing process, so what are some of the other things that that might include?
Yeah, so it all involves the continuum of the birthing process. And so from the time someone is pregnant all the way up until their child or children is 1 year, or the mother and the family is 1 year postpartum. And so we're really here spending some time acknowledging and recognizing that pregnancy is a very profound, transformative, sacred journey and process. And there are specific ways in which we are to connect and ways in which we are to engage with our pregnant and birth individuals and families. And the piece around ensuring that one, especially for our BIPOC pregnant and birth individuals, which is why we focus on this population and community, because unfortunately we have one of the greatest disparities. And it's all rooted in the realities of structural racism, implicit biases, obstetric violence. And so for Black and brown families in the South Coast, we actually have one of the highest infant mortality. Bristol County, I'm sorry, has one of the highest infant mortality. And we have maternal morbidity is sky rising, right? We have a report through Massachusetts Department of Public Health that shows that since 2011, that our maternal morbidity has actually increased, and as well as infant mortality. So this is something that is critically important for us to pay attention to within our community, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity. But we are centering these individuals and these communities, as I said, because we fear the worst.
Well, I definitely want to get into some of that disparity, but I think part of the issue, not just with that, but overall, is that we've so medicalized the idea of giving birth that
Certainly.
Everything becomes about, like, you know, and then you're going to this appointment here, and then this is when you're supposed to do this, that we've kind of taken away some of the spiritual aspect of what motherhood and Right. impending motherhood is all about.
Absolutely. I appreciate you for sharing the piece around the spiritual aspect. And I think it's also important to be able to state this, that when we talk about spirituality, we're talking about humanity,
right?
Right? It's not necessarily a dogma. It's not religiosity. We're talking about the realities of humanity. And absolutely, the piece where pregnancy and birthing has, which also really speaks to the reality of what it means to be a pregnant or a birthing individual, or even a woman in this country. Right. And the historical context of even how did the field of obstetric come about? Right. It was really violating the bodies of Black and brown individuals in order to bring forth, you know, sort of all of the medical advancements that we have. And a lot of, you know, sort of what we see even in medical interventions is rooted in, you know, sort of anti-Blackness, rooted in anti-humanity. We can even say.
How so?
Oh my gosh. So for example, we give credit to the founder of gynecology, Dr. Sims, as I said, who really perfected his interventions on, you know, sort of brutalizing the bodies of Black and brown enslaved women, doing a handful of obstetric interventions, obstetric experimenting that really led to harm. And has also led to sterilization of Black and brown women. And we still see the remnants to that today, right? That as a Black and brown woman, just being Black and brown, indigenous person of color, walking into the medical system, you are either receiving, there's over intervention, which can be very harmful, or neglect. And one of the things that we really see is kind of that in the middle. And oftentimes when we talk about this, because I think it's important that we, you know, sort of situate this context where we are in the sense of geographically, that here in the South Coast, we have one of the highest cesarean births. We also have now even increase in unnecessary inductions, or I can also say unnecessary, you know, sort of cesarean births. And so these are because, you know, sort of medical establishments, and there has been interventions prematurely and unnecessarily without the real clinical basis for it.
So they basically say, you know, it'd just be easier if we did it this way.
It'd just be easier.
And
or
so it's more about what's for them than it is for the mother.
Absolutely. And we can, you know, sort of hear, oh my gosh, we have so many stories of pregnant and birthing individuals that have shared that to be their experience, right? You know, my doctor has been recommended an induction, because if you get an induction, at least you know that you'll be able to have me as a provider, for example, for your birth. Yeah. Or a number of, you know, sort of stories that we hear that really equates to poor outcomes. And so just as I was sharing the piece around obstetric violence, and we're talking about infant mortality, maternal mortality, and morbidity, one of the things that we don't necessarily always see, especially within Bristol County and South Coast, is maternal mortality, right? Our Black and brown mothers aren't dying like the boroughs of New York, where you literally have Black and brown women dying 10 times at a greater rate than their white counterpart. We're not necessarily experiencing that. However, we're seeing a lot of obstetric trauma. We're seeing women, you know, sort of moving through their birthing journey and, you know, sort of returning home, feeling broken, feeling lost and unsatisfied.
And it seems, you know, the medical community tries so hard and you know, they try to eliminate any bias in the care that you receive. But you're saying that this still does occur and that it's inherited, it's institutionalized. How come that is the case? Why do you think that disparity still exists?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, sort of no different than racism exists today, right? And, you know, that has not, although we don't have enslaved individuals, racism and systematic racism has continues to exist, and it has ship-shaped and looked in various ways. And so that's, you know, sort of one of the primary reasons why we see the harm and the outcomes that we see. And I think the other piece that is important for us to talk about is when we think about the individuals that, you know, I oftentimes say that the harm and these traumas that are happening aren't just like in the air, right? They are, you know, sort of done through the caretaking of providers. And there is something to be said that we're talking about an institution that standardized everything, mm-hmm. right? In order to for things to keep running, right? It's a business. And so in that process, then you basically lose so much. You lose that human touch. You lose that connection to really understand who is the individual that is in front of you. And especially during, you know, sort of pregnancy and even prenatal, you know, sort of journey, right? And prenatal, what is that? Prenatal is really this time in this process of having a soul level connection between the provider and, you know, sort of the pregnant individual and their family, to be able to support them through this divine process of birth.
And so with Sacred Birthing Village, it sounds like you do remove, or you're able to remove, a lot of that anxiety that people will have.
Absolutely.
And even somebody who's had 3 or 4 kids doesn't mean that anxiety isn't there for number
well
5.
Well said, right.
So,
right.
You know, the fact that you can be there for them and kind of make this more of the, and they just said bring back the humanity of it. Because
absolutely.
As a medical procedure, you know, childbirth is scary. I was worried when my wife was going to have birth for our son
Absolutely.
Because of the medical issues that were happening around it. But when you look at it at that human side and you think to yourself, this is something that's been going on for millions of years, long before there were doctors to take part in it.
Right.
And what was so successful about those? Why did those work and what didn't work? And that, you know, leads you to be able to have that connection while not losing the ability to safely deliver a child.
Absolutely. And so you said something that I think is really important to accentuate. One is that pregnancy and childbirth is not a medical event. In the medical establishment, we have been taught that, but it actually isn't. It is a very instinctual and a spontaneous process. Really, what that means is that pregnant and birthing individuals actually don't necessarily need to be taught, or birth doesn't need to be intervened. And actually, the more that we can leave birth to be undisturbed, and I can already hear the views are saying, well, what about high-risk pregnancies? What about individuals that do need the intervention? Absolutely, right? I'm not having this conversation in a universal way. Each individual is different. What my experience has been, and the experiences of our sisters at Sacred Birthing Village, is that oftentimes when we talk about high-risk, isn't high-risk, right? We can't talk about, especially in the realm of reproductive justice and health equity, we can't talk about, you know, sort of these injustices without talking about the other injustices, such as housing, right? The housing crisis, homelessness, food insecurities, all of these different things, because these things absolutely play a huge role in how we show up in our humanity, right? How we show up in our relationships and how that shows up physically within our health, all of our health, right? The physical, the emotional, the psychological, and the spiritual. So that's something that's really important, because oftentimes when we talk about this work, especially for us, Sacred Birth and Village, we're situated here in the South Coast in New Bedford, and we work really closely with our healthcare system, South Coast Health. It is really important that we expand the blindfolders, or actually remove them altogether, and really have a more expansive view and understanding what is birth, what is pregnant, you know, what even what are pregnant and birthing individuals, what are their experiences, and then how do we engage with them that really aligns with what is physiologically true.
And you just brought up something that I think is an important point of emphasis, because people might be listening to this and saying, it sounds like what you're saying flies in the face of what the medical community will tell us. But it's important to note that the reason why you're here, the reason why you're able to be here, is that this is the South Coast Health Community Spotlight. This is something that they are sponsoring so that you'll be able to get this message out, which means that they are supportive. And as you said, you're working with them. So this is something that works hand in hand with the medical
community. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it takes us all. Right. And I want to go back to something that you said before. What was birth like, and how were babies coming into the world before the medical complex industry? It was at the hands of midwives. It was at the hands of women in the community that understood what was their role that they had to play in ensuring that there was safe passage for a new life to come into the community. And at the hands of traditional and indigenous midwives, without many medical access to many medical tools, interventions, we were able to see many babies have a healthy, successful journey earthside. And so what changed that is the introduction of obstetric, is the introduction of, you know, sort of the medical industry and nurses. And for a lot of, for example, the granny midwives of the South were, you know, sort of, there was a huge hunting of, you know, sort of the, these midwives that strategically, it was a strategic process to basically, you know, take them out of their calling. And this is something that is so profound for me, and is very sacred, because I think of myself, what is my purpose? What is my role at this time and where we are, and the calling to be able to support? And it's beyond support, right? We use this word support very loosely, but really that responsibility too. And the way that I see it for myself, and this deeper calling for Sacred Birth and Village, is that as much as we can, is that we don't disturb what is, as I said, physiologically, what is divine, and to understand what is our role as humans and what is our role as coming alongside pregnant and birth individuals, but to also be careful that we don't play God. And I think that this is something that is really important, is how do you engage in this dance? And we can do that on a communal care level. The, you know, sort of medical establishment becomes really hard to do that. And I don't have to, you know, each person can kind of hear this and kind of bring in their own experiences to accentuate what I just said.
And you mentioned that you focus on the BIPOC community. Is it exclusive to that, or is it really open to anybody that would like to go through the birthing journey this way?
Absolutely. So we focus specifically on our BIPOC pregnant and birthing sisters. And I will say that it's not exclusive. Nothing has been exclusive in the sense of even like historically that anytime that we center Black and Brown Indigenous individuals in anything, our other races and other ethnicities have always benefited. That's how this nation has been built. And so right now we have majority of our participants are BIPOC individuals, Cape Verdeans, Haitians, Latinos, Latinas, and Latinos as well, because we work as, you know, sort of a family unit. But absolutely, if you're someone that feels like, yes, I understand, you know, sort of the foundation to this work and this calling of Sacred Birth and Village, and I align with it, and absolutely, you know, sort of we welcome anyone to come, but that we are, you know, definitely focused on our BIPOC families.
And working with South Coast Health and other health organizations, What's the outreach like? Do they mm-hmm. need to find you, or do you reach out to the folks who are pregnant? How do you
yeah.
get the folks the information that they need?
Certainly. So it's been word of mouth how many of our participants and families have come to us. We also have, you know, sort of a referral system and process. And so at South Coast Health, many of the providers are aware and have actually, you know, sort of worked closely with Sacred Birth and Village, especially the nurse midwives. And so they will often go ahead and refer their patients to us. And then we kind of work, you know, sort of side by side throughout the entire journey. And then for Sacred Birth and Village, we just continue the journey, as I said, to 1 year postpartum. And, but for folks that might be listening and saying, I'd love to learn more, I'd love to connect with Sacred Birth and Village, come reach us, you know, reach out to us directly. That's one of the things that has been truly a blessing, is that we have done and we continue to intentionally focus on how to not have too much stuff in between, you know, sort of the pregnant and birth individuals and their families and us. And so, you know, a straight shot is where it's at. And so we encourage folks to reach out to us via phone call, via email, or even better yet, just give us a call and say, when are you all at the village? And please come by, come sit down. Let's have tea. There's always a pot of soup. There's always food, because sitting down at a table together and breaking bread together, that is powerful. And so we invite folks to, yeah, please.
I was going
to
say, that sounds like you're, you know, the village portion of the name really is everybody coming together.
Absolutely.
In the way that people have for forever.
Forever, right? We've done this forever. But, you know, the realities of capitalism, the realities of what it means to keep putting food on the table and keeping this world, you know, going, we have been cut off from a lot of these experiences. And so really for us, in this mission of maternal restoration and communal restoration and care, is really helping us to remember, reclaim, revive, and restore these practices that has always been indigenous to us, and that has also allowed us to be right where we are today.
And so just give everybody the information if they want to reach out, if they want to call, if they want to come by, where can they find you?
Sure. So we are located at 80 Rivet Street. We've been, you know, sort of been a blessing to be held. So the very things that we preach and that we practice is also reciprocated to us. And so we are in North Star Learning Center's building. And that's just because we have an amazing mama of the community, Maria Rosario, who loves us and we love her, has provided us this space. And so folks can, you know, connect with us there. But as I said, it's best to call us beforehand, and so we can be reached at 774-503-4218, or folks can also email us at maternalrestoration@sbvsouthcoast.org, or email me directly, soraya@sbvsouthcoast.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing this important information.
Thank you. Thank you. Such an honor, such a pleasure. Thank you for giving me this time.
All right, we've got to take a break right now. When we come back, we will have the news with Phil. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more in just a bit here on WBSM. All right, it is time now to go into the newsroom and get an update on all the top stories of the day from Phil Devitt.
The Syrian government collapses. What President Biden had to say. President-elect Trump talks deportation plans. And what's the best Christmas song of all time?
From the WBSM Newsroom, this is WBSM News.
President Biden says at long last, the Assad regime has fallen in Syria. Speaking from the White House on Sunday, Biden said the U.S. will work with other allies in the Middle East to protect the region from ISIS and other terrorist factions while supporting an independent Syria. Biden spoke briefly following a meeting with his national security team after Syrian rebels toppled the government of President Bashar al-Assad and captured the Syrian capital of Damascus. The U.S. military has about 900 troops stationed in northeastern Syria, defending against Islamist militants. Israeli forces are claiming Hezbollah violated a ceasefire agreement Sunday. Israel Defense Forces said the Israeli Air Force struck a storage facility in southern Lebanon after alleging Hezbollah was operating within a weapons storage facility, which it claims was a violation of the ceasefire because members were operating there. The IDF went on to say it was only operating according to the agreement and maintained ceasefire conditions on its end. President-elect Trump says children born in the U.S. could be deported if their parents are in the country illegally. In an interview with NBC's Meet the Press, Trump said he doesn't want to break up families, and so children may have to leave alongside their undocumented parents once he takes office. Trump also reaffirmed his commitment to ending birthright citizenship. He also appeared to say his administration's deportation efforts would go well beyond undocumented immigrants convicted of crimes and target others as well. Despite the comments, Trump insisted he wants to keep immigrants who are so-called dreamers, those brought to the U.S. as children and enrolled in the DACA program. The manhunt for the gunman who shot and killed the CEO of a major healthcare company now in day six. Authorities believe the suspect left the New York City area shortly after Wednesday's attack in Midtown Manhattan. The FBI and law enforcement agencies around the country are helping the NYPD, and photos of the suspect have been posted at patrol stations along the Mexican and Canadian borders. The FBI is offering a $50,000 reward for information leading to the suspect's arrest, the NYPD offering an additional $10,000. Judy Garland's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz have sold at auction for $28 million. Heritage Auctions in Dallas says it's the most valuable movie memorabilia ever sold at auction. With house commissions, the total price for the iconic slippers came to over $32 million. The slippers are one of four surviving pairs that Garland wore in the 1939 film. The other original slippers have also sold at auction, but not for nearly as much. That was not the only Wizard of Oz memorabilia sold this weekend. The black hat worn by the Wicked Witch, also up for auction, sold for $2 million. And according to a list compiled by Newsweek, the most popular Christmas song ever made is Bing Crosby's White Christmas, officially released in 1942. The hit was the title track of Crosby's White Christmas musical and quickly became a favorite of members of the United States Armed Forces. Other songs that topped the list include Crosby's Silent Night, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, Gene Autry's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and Band-Aid's Do They Know It's Christmas, to round out the top five.
WBSM Sports.
Bruins in Canada to play the Winnipeg Jets on Tuesday. Celtics home to play the Detroit Pistons on Thursday. Patriots back at it Sunday in Arizona to play the Cardinals.
Now your ABC 6 South Coast forecast.
Increasing clouds today with light to moderate rain developing in the afternoon. Rainfall amounts likely reach near a half inch by tonight. Tuesday will be overcast in between storm systems. As for temperatures, a high of 47 degrees today and 45 degrees on Tuesday. This WBSM news update is brought to you by Stevie's Wine and Spirits. Look for the purple dot to try before you buy, only at Stevie's Wine and Spirits in Fairhaven. I'm Phil Devitt for WBSM News. Stay up to date with New Bedford's news talk station, WBSM, and get all of our content and breaking news alerts with a WBSM app.
Hit it!
Na 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 na. Big up the crew in the area. Still have it like that. No, no, we don't die. Yes, we multiply. Anyone pressed will hear the fat lady sing. Act like you know, recall. I know what Bo don't know. Touch them up and go. Oh, cha-cha-ching, ching. Here come the hot stepper. I'm the lyrical gangster. Excuse me, Mr. Officer. Still have it like that. Extraordinary. Juice like a straw.
And welcome back in. 508-996-0500. The question that I threw out today was because the ruby slippers have gone for $28 million. is the auction price, but it'll be like $32.5 million with all the fees. What movie memorabilia would you most like to own? And Terry says he would like to own the painting from Good Will Hunting. If you remember the painting that's in Robin Williams' office. So if you would, you know, you can, if you really want to have a replica of that, Terry, you can order them online. I saw them for like $12.95. You know, you got to frame it yourself. But you could have that. It's not the same. The original, I guess, was actually painted by Gus Van Sant, the director of Good Will Hunting, to look like a Winslow Homer. But you could get the replica of it and hang that up. But that was my caveat to that question, was it had to be, you know, it's a prop, so it's not going to actually do what it does in the movie. Also, there's another story that I'd like to discuss. That today is the day that the city of Warwick, actually West Warwick, rather, is putting into effect enforcing its ban on homeless encampments. So these are on town property. So this will be something that is no longer allowed on town property. However, they're not going out today and conducting sweeps to get everybody off the street, but they said that they will be doing that in the future. So for right now, the folks who are, you know, camped out, which they estimate there's about 11 encampments with almost 40 people living in them on these town-owned properties, they'll be able to stay there today, but they are coming to eventually move them on. And a lot of the, so Channel 10 has the story where they went out and spoke to some of the people in these encampments who said that the problem is there's just not enough beds for them to go to other places. And then if they do have beds available, the places are too restrictive and make them feel like, you know, they're as one person said, like they're in prison. But they also, you know, one of them that they spoke to, Jason Reynolds, said, we pay our taxes. Some of us, most of us work. We go out and work. We just can't afford $1,600 to $2,000 for a one or two bedroom apartment. They can't afford the electricity, the food and everything else where they're raising the prices and raising the prices. It's just hard for people. So this is the way that they're saving money, is by living outdoors. And, you know, I know people who can live with the bare minimum of accommodations to be able to survive. I went through it myself. I lived in a tent. I didn't miss a meal. I didn't miss a doctor's appointment. My parents still worked. We still had clothes, clean clothes. I mean, our situation was a little bit different. It you know, it wasn't because we couldn't afford to go somewhere. It's because we didn't want to go somewhere else. Similar to what these folks are saying. You know, we made the decision rather than have to move to a different town that we would choose this lifestyle for a brief period of time until we found a place in the town we wanted to stay in, because it was hard to find a place where we felt like it was home. But this is how a lot of people choose to live. Now, the problem is this is town-owned property that they're on. If they found somebody who said, I don't care if you camp in the back part of my property. And in fact, there are probably people that would allow for that, not only because of their own personal beliefs about, you know, homelessness and these folks, but maybe they have a reason to want somebody to be on the property 24 hours a day. Maybe they have a reason to want somebody that would be there at night that could keep an eye out for fires or keep an eye out for trespassers or just discourage trespassers in general. Not to compare a person to a dog, but, you know, think of the places that have to have a guard dog to try to keep people out. Well, if people are living there, that's going to keep people out. So if they were on private property, this would be a non-issue. But they're on publicly owned property, and that's where it becomes an issue. And it's not just because there are people in town who pay taxes for that property and they don't want to have homeless people living on that property. Like, shut up. Okay, this isn't about you and what you want. All right, these are about people that need a place to live. But the reason why they can't allow it on town property isn't because of those people. It's because of the fact that if they allow these people to camp there, then everybody has to camp there. So if the city of New Bedford was to say, we have no problem with people camping in some of these, you know, in Brooklawn Park. We have no problem if people want to camp in Brooklawn Park. And I choose that one because I don't think there's anybody actually camping in Brooklawn. So if you chose to camp there and they allowed that to happen, well, then that means when I want to take a vacation and I want to go camping and I don't feel like paying $40 a night for a campsite, I should be able to just go set up shop in Brooklawn Park because, you know, hey, we pay taxes too, right? So we should be able to camp on the lawn. And again, I don't own property in New Bedford, but still, just go with me here on the example. And that means that anybody that wanted to do that. So now Brooklawn Park goes from being a public space where people can go and play and walk their dogs and throw a frisbee and jog and do all that stuff, ride their bikes, whatever, into a campground. And that's what the issue is here. It's about, and then, by the way, too, if you're going to let somebody camp on it, well, then now somebody wants to go and set up a business on it. Well, if they're allowed to camp here and live here, then why can't I park my, you know, food truck in the middle of the park and operate there? So these are all the issues that come up as a result of it. And that's why, you know, as much as I think, yes, you need to let these homeless people have a place to live where they feel like they have whatever decency they have there, it can't happen on town or city-owned property. 5089, and so, you know, that idiot caller that calls in and says that I hatched up the, it was my brainchild, me and Shane Burgo working together to come up with the homeless encampments, you know, that kind of takes your whole the wind out of all your sails, right? Because I'm not for it. But if somebody said, I've got a piece of property and I have no problem with a homeless encampment being on my property, well, then more power to them. Huh?
That's how Woodstock happened.
Well, I think they were planning on them going home at some point at Woodstock. All right, we got to take a break here. We'll be back in just a few moments. 508-996-0500.
Sit back with my brand new invention. Yeah. Something grabs a hold of me tightly. Flow like a harpoon daily and nightly.
Will it ever stop?
Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights and I'll glow. To the extreme, I rock a mic like a vandal. Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle. Dance. Crush a speaker that booms. I'm killing your brain like a poisonous mushroom. Deadly. When I play a dope melody, anything less than the best is a felony. Love it or leave it, you better gain weight. You better hit bullseye, the kid don't play. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook while my DJ revolves it.
All right, that is, of course, the great MC himself, Vanilla Ice. Ice Ice Baby. And there was some Ice Ice Baby out on the roads the last couple of nights, but it's going to be warm the next couple of days, warm enough that the rain that's coming won't freeze, but then things will take a dip again. And, you know, Phil's been telling us all morning how the most popular Christmas song is White Christmas, but I am somebody that doesn't care if we get a White Christmas or not, because I don't like snow. I don't mind if there's a little bit that falls, like Christmas Eve, once I'm home. And if it falls down and then it doesn't stick to the ground, that's what I like. But I was leaving my paranormal event in Weymouth Saturday night and they're like, oh, it's snowing out. I'm like, damn it. I got to drive back to the South Coast and this. And it wasn't too bad, but still, I hate snow. And I'm sure that's just a me problem. But I know many people that do. I also know many people that are like, I hope we get buried under 2 feet of snow. And I'm like, of course, because you don't need to go anywhere. You don't need to drive to the radio station and be on the air because we're here no matter what. Except holidays. Taking Christmas and New Year's Day off. So anyway, speaking of time off, I've got to take some time off right now to play some more commercials. Wrap up my final break of the morning. We'll be right back.
I want to get with me. My threads are fresh and I'm looking.
Now that's Tone Loc and Funky Cold Medina, which when I was in middle school, my